proceed to the fourth case, Chavez versus the United States. Mr. Bindi.
Good morning, and may it please the court. The holding in Padilla versus Kentucky that criminal defense counsel render deficient performance when they fail to advise non-citizen clients of the immigration consequences of a guilty plea established a new rule within the meaning of Teague versus Lane, which does not apply retroactively to cases like the petitioner's, which became final before the rule was announced, because the rule was not dictated by precedent.
Well, now, the court in Padilla wrote the duty to give correct advice is equally clear, and that we have long recognized the negotiation of a plea bargain as a critical phase of litigation for purposes of the Sixth Amendment right to ineffective assistance of counsel. Why is this language not sufficient to suggest it was a mere application of Strickland versus a new rule?
There is more to it than just the application of Strickland to these facts, Your Honor. There had to be an answer to an antecedent question before the court could proceed with the Strickland analysis, and the antecedent question was whether Strickland applied at all to advice about a collateral consequence, namely the immigration consequences of a guilty plea. And that, too, was a new rule. No court had ever so held before. And as the dissenting opinions and the opinion concurring in the judgment noted, this was a dramatic expansion of the duties of criminal defense counsel, and it was unprecedented. So that's why this is more than a mere straightforward application of the Strickland principles. Now, the district court believed that this was just a straightforward application of Strickland for two reasons. First, that the Padilla case itself was on collateral review, and second, that the issue would evade review if it was not reached in a collateral proceeding. And there was one answer to both of these points, and that answer is that Padilla was a case that came out of state court, and Teague versus Lane is not binding on state courts. State courts are free to apply new rules retroactively, regardless of the jurisprudential holding in Teague versus Lane. A decision that not only was not dictated by precedent, there's nothing in Supreme Court jurisprudence to suggest that this would be the outcome of a decision on this issue. And the lower federal courts and the state courts are unanimous prior to Padilla as stating that advice about immigration consequences is not required by the Sixth Amendment.
Does the dictated by precedent language of Teague still apply in the Strickland context, given the court's language in Williams versus Taylor and other Strickland cases?
I would say that yes, it does. None of those cases alters the basic Teague versus Lane analysis. And Schreiro versus Summerlin supports that assertion. That case also reinforces the notion that dictated does mean dictated. And again, in this context, we're talking about an application of Strickland that had to be preceded by a decision on the antecedent question, which is whether Strickland even applies to this fact scenario.
Now, we held that counsel was not ineffective for failing to advise about immigration consequences back in the George case in 1989.
That is correct.
But hasn't a lot of change taken place between then and Chavez's plea, such as the enormous expansion of mandatory removable offenses, the changes in professional standards which are relevant under Strickland, and the court's language of the severity of deportation in INS versus St. Cyr?
There is no question that there have been a lot of changes in immigration law, but there have been no decisions of federal courts or state courts, for that matter, which conclude that advice about immigration consequences is constitutionally mandated. St. Cyr makes the point that immigration consequences of a criminal conviction may be of paramount importance to the person who is convicted and facing deportation. But still, the basic principle that the Sixth Amendment requirement is confined to advice about the criminal prosecution and the defense of the criminal case and a potential plea in the criminal case didn't change. As far as bar association standards and professional norms, those obviously are not irrelevant. They inform the decision that counsel makes about what sort of advice is required. But bar norms and professional standards do not establish the baseline Sixth Amendment requirement until the Supreme Court says they do. The Supreme Court has not abdicated its authority to bar associations to set professional standards mandated by the Sixth Amendment. And so, Your Honors, for these reasons, we would respectfully request that the judgment be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Bendy. Mr. Gutierrez?
Please, the Court, Counsel. Judge, this is not a new rule. This is an extension of an old rule. I believe that Justice Kennedy, in his concurrence in Wright versus West, said that it's a new beginning point of an old rule of general application. And in that case, he was talking about the sufficiency of the evidence. In this case, we're talking about the collateral or direct consequences of entering into a plea of guilty.
So the fact that the lower courts have generally held that there was no Strickland violation when a lawyer failed to advise a client about immigration consequences, you're saying that that does not support the government's position?
Right. That's correct, Judge. I believe that the government is trying to say, in essence, that that this does not extend Strickland because this is a new rule that governs the legal advice that's not directly related to defending the prosecution of a case itself. But as you know, Judge, the prosecution of a case, when you're entering into plea negotiations, is really the attorney acting as an aid, so to speak, to the prosecution process. It's saying, I've reviewed your case. Here are the potential penalties that you're facing, and this is why I believe that you should plead guilty, give up all of your constitutional rights to a trial, to compulsory process, all of the rights that are attendant to any person accused of a crime, and say, okay, I believe that it's up to you to plead guilty, because if you plead guilty, you are deferring the full onset of potential penalties that you could face. Rather, here are the penalties that you're facing. And, as the court has stated, to leave out to a non-citizen probably the most important aspect of that penalty, which is the second penalty, the deportation aspect of it, that I believe Justice Stevens in Padilla said it makes no difference, because in Strickland itself, it didn't distinguish between collateral consequences and direct consequences.
So is removal or deportation still a collateral consequence of a plea or does this distinction even matter anymore?
I believe that this distinction has frayed at the edges, and that ultimately the Supreme Court is saying, look, we're past 1996. We're past the Real ID Act. We're past St. Cyr. Gentlemen, ladies, it's time to raise the goalpost from 10 feet to 10.6. I believe that this is just a bar, as earlier commented on, that ABA has set new standards. It's an application whose time has come. Let's extend Strickland to include whether it's collateral or direct consequences. It's such an important consequence for a non-citizen to face that the Supreme Court is essentially saying, let's not draw a distinction between what will happen to a person who is a citizen versus what may happen, and in this case undoubtedly would happen, to Ms. Chaidez if in fact she was convicted and took a plea to a case that she didn't know would lead to her inevitable deportation. There is no remedy for her but for vacating the sentence.
Well, Mr. Gutierrez, if you seem to suggest this was sort of evolutionary. We were on this road.
Yes.
But back to Judge Williams' inquiry about no court of appeals seeing it to date. And then, well, obviously the dissent does not control, but sometimes informs. The dissents, in commenting on the eventual holding of the Supreme Court, seems so clearly to suggest that, you know, reasonable minds could disagree on the approach and that it was such a dramatic departure. Are there any teachings to be had? Where is the possession arrow pointing when we look at those comments? That's all.
Well, I believe that that in regard to immigration consequences, I think that that's a wholly new and evolving storyline, so that I can anticipate that if there was any type of distinctions made between, say, gender, the gender issue, you know, it takes time to deliberately move away from a class society, a gender-specific society, and I think that you're correct, you know, that the arrow is starting to point the way it did before, whether it was racial, whether it was gender specific. I think that eventually, as we evolve as citizens, as we evolve as a cognitive society, that
well, to take your point, then in the broad context, the global approach that you suggest, there'll never be a new rule because we're on the road to constitutional protection, so to speak. So what does that do to Teague?
Well,
the teachings of Teague?
I'm sure it limits Teague to a certain extent, and I'm not going to suggest that Teague is dead, but certainly where you're dealing with procedure versus substance, I think that could be a very dramatic distinction. I know that the Teague case suggested that, you know, in certain types of interrogation, police interrogations, things that directly impact the states, that it's up to the states to determine for themselves how you're to proceed with this new rule. And that's why I believe it's not binding on the states. But when you're dealing with a whole body of a class of persons, that's why I commented on the gender specific, on the race specific, when you're dealing with a whole group of people that suddenly need, as you stated, constitutional protection, then to look at Strickland in terms of whether it's collateral or whether it's direct, I think it's to take two steps backwards. If you're going to require the Strickland analysis to adhere to those requirements of whether it's collateral or direct consequences, I think that Strickland is a standard which applies to all attorneys giving advice to their clients. And I think one of the things that the Justice Stevens had commented on was the fact that we don't want criminal defense lawyers to be silent on a position that is of utmost importance, that is the time to make a decision whether to give up all of your rights, whether to give up all of your constitutionally protected trial rights, will someday be foreshortened, as it were, by the fact that you omitted to say, listen, And also, Padilla does talk about a balancing test, as you know. It says that the higher the probability of certainty in deportation, the greater the need for an attorney to inform their client of that fact. If it's just a consequence where there's sort of defenses to it, and you know, there's cancellation of removal, there's waivers of deportation, there's a multitude of things that criminal defense lawyers shouldn't be having to know about. But there are these class of deportation cases. In other words, this is not new immigration law. This is new deportation law. This is about removal law. So I would just narrow it down. Instead of the big, broad field of immigration, we're talking strictly about the removal aspect.
Well, if we find retroactive application, what limits are there on vacating every plea from a non-citizen where there's an allegation of failure to warn? In other words, you know, is there a prejudice? Is a prejudice finding automatic if a non-citizen alleges she would have gone to trial but for lack of advice?
Well, the good thing to that question, Judge, is that that question is being asked all the time, and now the states are putting forth a body of case law that suggests in some areas yes and in some areas no. I mean, it has to be on a case-by-case basis. Everybody has different underlying factors. One of those factors is not only the certainty of deportation, but the underlying nature of the ties to the community, I think, are whether the person's a lawful permanent resident, whether a person has no color of law here, whether a person – I've had cases where there was some strong color of law, but the person had never gone to an immigration lawyer to say, listen, you've been in the country for 10 years, you have a spouse that's a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident, or you have children born here. You're a person of good moral character. I think you should apply for something. And then without that information, say they pick up a case that brings them into the fold, as it were, and suddenly I think that that person, too, might benefit from this. And it doesn't just have to be a clear-cut, dry case. And I'm not going to close the door on anybody. Is that that's
well,
what I'm
saying? When we talk about the prejudice aspect of it, though, I mean, and whether everybody would get an automatic vacation of a plea, is there also the factor of looking at the evidence in terms of what the charge is? So if the evidence was overwhelming, let's say, of guilt on an aggravated felony, at some point there would be no prejudice if someone failed to warn. Is that right?
I would say no. I would say the only thing that the prejudice should look at isn't whether you're guilty or not, because we're presumed not guilty. So no matter how much evidence you have, you know, any evidence can be attacked because that's all it is. It's evidence. Whether it's circumstantial, direct, it's still evidence. I think that the issue should turn.
But I was assuming there was a plea. You know,
right.
And then there's a motion to vacate when we're talking about this retroactivity, trying to get to will every plea have to be vacated or will there be some other? I mean, it certainly there would be a need to show some prejudice. So
the prejudice prong on that should not look towards the prosecution of the criminal case. The prejudice aspect should look at what the remedies are to a person who, but for the conviction, would sustain some type of immigration relief. I think the prejudice should be if the person has no relief other than to say, well, you know, but for this conviction, I would have gotten the right to voluntarily depart the United States, you know, that might be less of prejudice than if but for the conviction, I would remain.
Yeah, but Ms. Gutierrez, just for a second to follow up on Judge Williams' question, would we have to, under a retroactivity scheme, have to go back to the plea and see how solid that was, mm-hmm. no matter what. I mean, because you were suggesting evidence is evidence, and you know, I mean, would every plea have to be subject at least to a rescrubbing, so to speak?
Well, certainly it would have to be rescrubbed, Judge, but it cannot be rescrubbed certainly by weighing the evidence. I think that it has to be rescrubbed by weighing the plea itself. I mean, evidence is evidence, but when you're saying...
But see, what I'm trying to get at is, you know, when we're trying to, for example, any error in taking a guilty plea, we find that there's been a constitutional violation. The court neglected to advise on certain rights. And then we always look at, but what was the prejudicial impact of that? What was the impact of it? And we look at, we weigh, was the evidence like overwhelming, slam dunk on a videotape, no questions asked, but you're saying, no, we have to still go back in.
Yes, I am saying no, Judge, and I'm not going to give an inch on that.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gutierrez. I didn't want to cut you off. Did you have another comment?
Oh,
okay. Mr. Bendy?
And I have a question for you in terms of sort of the consequences. You say in your brief that the floodgates language in Padilla was only about state post-conviction proceedings. Is there any support for that opinion? And I want to also ask, because the majority sort of downplays the opening of the floodgates to convictions already obtained. And isn't that an indication that it conceived of the case's application to convictions that have become final, like the one in this case? So it's really a two-parter.
I think, Your Honor, that it is very problematic to try and read anything about retroactivity into the Padilla opinion itself. The court did not outwardly decide that question in the case, and I don't think that you can put that much into the language that they used. As far as the floodgates go, I think they didn't specify what they were referring to. By that comment, they didn't flesh that out. But I think it's fairly reasonable to project, especially because Padilla itself was a case that arose out of state court, that they were talking about potential state court floodgates in that regard. In response to the inquiry about prejudice, my understanding of the application of Strickland to ineffective assistance in guilty pleas is that if the defendant can establish that but for the deficient performance, the defendant would have not pleaded guilty and gone to trial instead, that's the end of the game. Looking at whether or not there is overwhelming evidence, that's what the trial is for. You don't have evidence other than the plea colloquy at the time of a guilty plea. And so, for the government mm-hmm. to say, well, our evidence would have been overwhelming, and that's what the trial is for. An important part of the government's argument in this case is that this was not a straightforward, simple application of the two-part Strickland test, because before you even get to that, the court had to answer the antecedent question of whether or not Strickland even applies to advice about immigration consequences of a guilty plea. The petitioner never answered that argument in her brief, and she didn't answer it here today. And so, again, for these reasons, we would respectfully request that this court reverse the judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Bendy. Thanks to all counsel. Case is taken under advisement. Court will proceed.